You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Marcus Hippi.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, our man in Seoul, Jason Strother, reports on the meeting that fell apart before it began between North and South Korea.
I think there are a lot of hopes that these talks would lead to the reopening of some mutually beneficial economic joint ventures. But because of this disagreement over the delegation list, those discussions were called off.
Also coming up on the show, we head to Israel to find out why tech hubs and coffee culture are such a potent mix.
There's something in the coffee that is a nutrient for anything that demands a nutrient to grow, whether it's business, whether it's creativity, whether it's politics. Coffee makes our minds move.
And as Dublin this week celebrates James Joyce's Ulysses, we find out what's on at the Bloomsday Events and reflect on the lasting impact of Joyce's most famous work.
So there you go, culture, current affairs, plus we will of course play some music too. That is all to come in the next hour. You're listening to Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Turkish riot police have cleared the central Istanbul square where anti-government demonstrations began almost 2 weeks ago. Thousands of people were in Taksim Square when police stormed it on Tuesday evening. They fired tear gas on the protesters and running battles continued through the night. Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, who has repeatedly dismissed the demonstrators as riffraff, is expected to meet protest leaders later today, but one core group said it had not been invited and wouldn't attend anyway. Thousands of people spent the night at the headquarters of Greece's state TV station ERT in a show of support after the government shut it down without warning to save money. Screens went black during a news broadcast late on Tuesday evening. A government spokesman said the broadcaster was full of waste, with too many unnecessary employees, too much overspending on production, too much overtime pay, and too many programmes that no one was watching. He said a new channel, which would be more technically modern and have fewer staff, would be opened in its place. All staff have been suspended pending the reorganisation. Udine Lenardatu is one of the station's presenters.
It was a shock, and 2,600 people are going to be without a job tomorrow. And I hope that they would have given us a notice, because and this week I was preparing my show for a news that I have every week. And we didn't expect it. We didn't see that coming. We saw that maybe they were going to fire some people. We found that logically, but not to close ERT completely.
The Obama administration has launched an internal review of the potential damage to national security from leaks about US surveillance efforts. The announcement came as a group of senators and technology companies pushed the government to be more open about the top secret programs. A senior intelligence official said the review would be separate from a Justice Department criminal investigation into Edward Snowden's disclosures about the National Security Agency's broad monitoring of phone call and internet data from big companies such as Google and Facebook. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit in the US District Court challenging the legality of the telephone surveillance program, saying it violates free speech and privacy protections in the Constitution. Alex Abdo is staff attorney at the ACLU National Security Project.
This program is a massive and unprecedented grab of information by the intelligence agencies. They're sweeping up, or they're tracking, literally every call made in this country. And the Constitution simply doesn't allow the government to do that. If it has a reason to suspect a particular American of wrongdoing, then the government should target that American for investigation or surveillance. But they shouldn't indiscriminately sweep up the calls of millions of innocent Americans.
Volkswagen has recalled almost 26,000 cars in Australia in response to potential gearbox problems. The company says it'll be recalling Jetta, Polo, Passat and Caddy models manufactured between June 2008 and September 2011. Owners had complained of transmission and engine failures causing loss of power, and there have already been recalls in China, Singapore and Japan. The world's oldest person, 116-year-old Japanese man Jiromon Kimura, has died. Mr. Kimura, who lived near Kyoto in western Japan, had been taken to hospital last month suffering from pneumonia. On his 115th birthday, he told reporters he was keeping his mind fit by learning English, and he attributed his longevity to getting out in the sunlight. He's survived by 7 children, 14 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and 15 great-great-grandchildren. An Australian woman will today try to become the first person ever to make the 103-mile swim between Cuba and the Florida Keys without a shark cage to protect her. Guided by a support crew of 50 people, 29-year-old Chloe McArdle, who's from Melbourne, expects to take 60 hours to swim from Havana to the shores of Key West in Florida.
First of all is the record. This swim is 50% further than any person has successfully swum between two points of land in the ocean. My mum had breast cancer when I was 14, and I'm doing this for people who are living with cancer and those in the future who may have cancer.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barn. It is 6 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
We are live from Studio One in London as ever, and the time is 15:06 exactly in Hong Kong, 10:06 in Istanbul, 8:06 a.m. here in London.
But it is to Tokyo we fly now as we start the show with our daily agenda setter. Three stories you need to know for the next 24 hours, and agenda setter today is our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall. Good afternoon to you, Kenji. Let's start with the topic. We're going to be talking about this later on in the show as well, but let's talk about the first high-level talks in 6 years between North and South Korea that now have been scrapped. What exactly happened?
That's right. As you mentioned, this would have been the first time in 6 years that the North and South Korean sides would have high-level talks. Initially, it was supposed to be a ministerial-level discussion. South Korea had initially proposed sending its Minister of Unification. It was unclear who the North would send. In the end, South Korea said it would send a vice minister, and this apparently made the North Koreans very unhappy. They have called it a provocation and actually canceled the meeting.
Okay, so it is the agenda setter, and indeed it's setting the agenda for this very program, because we're going to be talking to our man in Seoul in a few minutes to dig down a little bit into that one, Kenji. So let's move on to the front page of the Japan Times, and a little bit of marital strife, it seems. We've seen behind the curtain of the Prime Minister. What's been going on?
Interestingly, yes, so Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been promoting Japan's atomic energy technology lately in discussions with leaders from France and from India, and also from Turkey. At the same time, his wife, Akie, doesn't seem to be on the same page. She specifically, I said, and it's interesting, she said this nearly a week ago, but it's only coming out today, that her heart aches to see him selling nuclear energy overseas, and that she's specifically opposed to nuclear power. Now, the timing of this is interesting also because over the weekend, about 60,000 people rallied in Tokyo to protest against the government's stated promise that it would most likely allow reactors that have been offline to be put online again. A lot of these, so Japan has 50 reactors, only two of which are online currently. The rest are offline due to safety inspections.
Kenji, how influential is the Prime Minister's wife, Akie, in this case?
Well, interestingly enough, this is her second time as the First Lady. The first time she was very, very quiet. This time she seems to be stepping out and voicing her opinion. At the same time, she's also saying, you know, that she is offering this just as a counter argument to her husband's ideas. She's not saying that the country should do this, but she's merely saying that this is her very honest opinion, which is, I think, a rare thing for a First Lady in Japan to be saying.
Well, rare it may be. I wonder if how sort of complicit Shinzo Abe is in this sort of revelation, because I suppose politically it's not a bad thing for him. The sort of opposition voice gets voiced by someone very close to home. Everyone sort of sees him as a human being with a sort of home life as well. I mean, is the result of this ultimately pretty positive for him?
I don't know. It's mixed. You know, his wife, Akiya, is also behind his not moving into the Kante, which is the official residence of the prime minister. He continues to live at home, actually very close to our very own Fiona Wilson. And, you know, the traffic jams that are caused because he has to go to and from his house to the Diet and also to the official residence are not making local residents very happy. So that's an interesting aside as well. I think in general he's been promoting women in the working world. He's said that he wants to tap this dormant workforce, and so in some ways, you know, it's probably a good thing that his wife is stepping out and you know, putting forth her own ideas.
And has the Prime Minister reacted to his wife's comments?
At this point, no. But I would imagine, you know, she's given several interviews with the Japanese press. And in those interviews, she has stated that she is opposed to nuclear energy. So I can imagine that the Prime Minister's staff would not really allow her or want her to be going and speaking with the press. This must definitely be sanctioned by the Prime Minister's office.
Interesting. And I suppose it does shine an interesting spotlight, doesn't it, on this sort of inherent tension. You've got the sort of change in Japanese attitudes towards nuclear technology on one side, and then on the other you've got the economic imperative, and it seems that at the moment the economic imperative is winning.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Shinzo Abe has specifically said he wants to be the country's top salesman. He's been taking delegations of businessmen with him whenever he travels overseas for diplomatic trips. And, you know, he really wants to promote nuclear energy overseas as a way of restarting and reviving Japan's economy. He thinks that it could be a key export in the future, especially given that around the world, you're seeing nuclear energy actually getting a boost. So he very much wants Japan to get a piece of that business. At the same time, it's a contradiction because back at home, you know, the general public is very much against nuclear energy and the promotion of nuclear energy, very wary of the dangers that it poses because of the Fukushima disaster. So, you know, we'll see where that ends up.
Kenji, let's move on to your third story. That's quite an interesting transport story from Japan. Central Japan Railway is about to start test runs, paving the way for the launch of the maglev train line between Tokyo and Nagoya. What is to be expected?
That's right. So this train line actually will not be operating until 2027. You know, this is classic Japan, where they have this incredible technology and it's actually commercially ready. And, you know, the head of Central Japan Railway has specifically said that the current trains that have been tested for years on an experimental line in Yamanashi Prefecture are ready to go. At the same time, the building of the track is going to take years, and getting residents on board is also going to take years. So at this point, they're saying we have incredible technology, but we're planning to spend the next 14 years perfecting it and making sure it's absolutely safe. Just a side note, Japan's Shinkansen, its current technology, has never had an accident. Only once has a train derailed, and that was because of a major earthquake. And even in that derailing, there were no injuries. So Japan has quite a sterling record with safety in railway technology.
Kenji Hall, many thanks for coming on the show.
Coming up, North and South Korea's planned talks, as we've been hearing, have fallen apart. We'll find out why and where next.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House and it is 15 minutes past the top of the hour. 3 months ago, every newspaper from Toronto to Tokyo was reporting that North Korea was pushing the world to the brink of conflict. There were missile tests, televised military exercises and a lot of rhetorical flourish in Pyongyang as Kim Jong-un flexed his muscles dramatically.
Indeed, but then the world stepped back from the brink. North Korea's rhetoric retreated behind the point of no return we had been told it had already crossed, and a few days ago we were even told North and South would be holding talks. But since then, a fly has landed in the diplomatic ointment and those talks have been cancelled. So what on earth has been going on? Jason Strother is our man in Seoul and he joins us now, hopefully to give us some answers. Jason, we were hearing from Kenji a moment ago that the problem was about rankings, about sort of diplomatic protocol. What exactly was the issue?
That's exactly right. Some people are saying that these talks were pretty much made to fall apart. From what the South Korean government side is saying, North Korea refused to send their high-ranking official here to Seoul for these talks that were supposed to start today. So Seoul followed suit. They were only going to send their vice minister of unification to attend the discussions. North Korea then turns around and says, no, 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 we're not going to meet with you. If you can't produce a minister-level official, then the talks are off. And thus they were canceled. And now North Korea isn't even answering the phone. Last week they reopened the Red Cross hotline. Seoul has tried twice today, one the second time just moments ago, and the North is no longer picking up the line.
So we have another backlash there. Why did North Korea insist so much that South Korea would have a higher-ranking official attending these talks?
Well, I think both sides are saying that they wanted someone who can make decisions, like real governmental decisions. The the Unification Ministry here says their vice minister was in that position, that it, you know, in the bureaucracy of the Unification Ministry, the vice minister does have the authority to make decisions. Seoul doesn't feel, though, that the official that Pyongyang was going to send was in that position. So it is a matter of protocol, but some people are just saying it was an excuse for Pyongyang to back out of the talks altogether.
Okay, so the talks have a fly in the ointment, as we were saying. Now, had they gone ahead, had all of this not become a problem and they'd managed to get around the table, what was top of the agenda? What was going to be discussed?
Well, unfortunately, a clear agenda was not set at a preliminary meeting over this past weekend, but both sides had said in previous discussions with the press or news releases that they'd hoped that the stalled business joint business ventures at the Kaesong Joint Industrial Complex and the Mount Diamond Mount Gumgang Resort in North Korea would be top on the agenda. Seoul also wanted to bring up the issue of family reunions, as there are still thousands of South Koreans who are waiting to meet their loved ones that they last saw before the Korean War 60 plus years ago. But now, both the economic ventures, both mutually beneficial to each country. Kaesong brought in, millions of dollars to the North Korean economy each year. It benefited about 120 South Korean factories with cheap labor, the 50,000 North Koreans who worked at the complex. And the tourist venture brought many South Korean visitors to North Korea's east coast. So I think there is some disappointment. And I just saw a press briefing with one of the heads of the Kaesong Joint Industrial Complex factory owners expressing his disappointment that these talks were canceled.
Jason, do we know what's going to happen next?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, Pyongyang didn't even issue a normally fiery statement condemning Seoul for blaming Seoul for canceling the talk. So we don't really know how North Korea is taking it all. And I don't know if South Korea feels it's in a position. They're putting the blame squarely on Pyongyang for the failure of these discussions to take place. Park Geun-hye, South Korea's president, says she's still keeping an open door to North Korea, that she wants to maintain a policy of rapprochement, but Seoul's unification minister in a press briefing earlier today said that North Korea needs to show that it's really sincere if it wants to welcome in a new era of inter-Korean relations.
Deary me, Jason, this is all pretty baffling, isn't it? I mean, it looked like we had a narrative sorted a few weeks ago, was very serious a few months ago, but they've sort of, both sides have stepped back from the brink. Everything is moving forward in an encouraging way. Was that all leading to this point? And now, is this an indicator, essentially, of the shape of things to come, if they're going to fall down on details as sort of apparently small as protocol issues, is that a sign of how difficult this process is going to be to move forward?
Well, the pendulum definitely swings back and forth here on the Korean Peninsula, and going from, you know, boiling hot rhetoric like we saw earlier this year to a more peaceful offers of rapprochement, not unusual. I have no ability to predict what might be the next step, but I mean, I think we can, this isn't the end of it. There will be efforts to talk, maybe even China and the U.S., who had an agreement over this past weekend to condemn North Korea about its nuclear weapons program. Maybe there might be some move now to get the six-party denuclearization talks back on track. But I don't know how much longer North Korea is going to want to go without having the Kaesong industrial complex, you know, shuttered. So we could see some more moves by both sides to get the ball rolling again. But it might take some time now, since both sides are trying to keep face.
Jason Strother is our man in Seoul. Jason, thank you very much for unpicking that rather complicated diplomatic issue for us. We'll speak to you again soon.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
For many, the process of cooking is as pleasurable as the meal itself. Cue the school bell. From a Tasmanian cook who guides his guest from garden to kitchen, to a chef-led market journey in Israel, Monocle Films have hand-selected some cookery schools who focus their flavors on learning.
A wide variety of courses are available. There are two-day butchery courses, a charcuterie special session, and even one focusing on tomatoes and all the ways to use them.
Eat, cook, learn on film on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. I've read and understood Ulysses. It's a phrase not many people can say with a straight face, except the odd English literature graduate trying to impress, or perhaps a Dubliner with a slightly heightened awareness of their own cultural past. It's famous for its dense prose, its obscure puns, and its allusions to the characters and events of Homer's epic Greek poem, The Odyssey. James Joyce's Ulysses, I should say. It's rather hard to say as well, apparently. Can this week be enjoyed by fans and those wishing to be acquainted with the work in Dublin? For this week hosts Bloomsday celebration.
So called after the main character in his most famous work, Leopold Bloom, on Ulysses, Bloomsday celebrated on June the 16th every year in Dublin, while celebrations of the author's work are ongoing throughout the week.
Well, in a moment, we're going to look into the influence of Joyce and his work with Professor Andrew Gibson. But first, let's find out whether the Dubliners will have to follow the trials and tribulations of the day in the life of Leopold Bloom at this week's events. We're joined by Bloomsday's Festival Director at the James Joyce Centre, Mr. Mark Trainer. Mark, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. What can we expect from the celebrations?
Well, it's kind of expanded from just being a day-long celebration to, I suppose, a week-long. In fact, there's actually things happening throughout the month of June. So the sort of traditional things that we always do, like the Bloomsday breakfast, we do walking tours of the city, I suppose, to demonstrate how you know, deeply embedded the work is in the topography of the physical city of Dublin itself. And then we've got things like, you know, kind of new theatre events. We have special talks. Tonight we're actually doing a really interesting event around the knocker from number 7 Eccles Street, the knocker from the front door of number 7 Eccles Street. A guy from New York removed the knocker from the door about 47 years ago, and it's finally been returned to us here at the centre. So there's loads of things on for loads of people from different backgrounds.
I was just about to ask how you would describe the audience, the admirers of James Joyce.
Well, it's really, really diverse. I mean, we get people from all over the world, from lots from the States, from all over Europe, Germany, Scandinavian countries, and then as far as, you know, Asia, China, Japan. So people come in from all over the world to celebrate celebrate Joyce, and then we also get a good mix of Dubliners. And I mean, it really is. You have academics, and then you have people who may not have read a lot of Joyce, but are familiar with, I suppose, his reputation, his legacy. And for them, it's kind of a point of entry into exploring what Joyce is really about.
Mark, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on what you're going to be up to. We're going to turn to Professor Andrew Gibson now. He's Research Professor of Modern Literature and Theory at Royal Holloway, London, and thus an expert in all things Joyce. He's an author, in fact, of Joyce's Revenge, History, Politics and Aesthetics in Ulysses. You've got to make sure you put that colon in the right place, haven't you? He joins us in the studio. Professor Gibson, thank you very much for joining us. Joyce has a reputation, doesn't he, for being the preserve of English literature students who want to show off, or being fiendishly difficult and impenetrable. Is that unfair?
No, I don't think in a way it is unfair. Ulysses is, I think, widely regarded as a modernist masterpiece and a great example of modernist bravura in art or in prose. And there is a kind of extravagance to it, a rather wonderful and strange extravagance that some of its readers have traditionally picked up on, and I suppose in a way replicated. But there are other and very different sides to Ulysses too.
There are so many people, and incredible amounts of people have actually tried to read Ulysses and actually failing. What would your tip or tips be to how to succeed in that mission?
My advice on how to read Ulysses. I don't think one can give a single piece of advice. One way of reading Ulysses and starting to love it is to read it out aloud, or to hear people reading it out aloud. Another way of reading, of learning how to read Ulysses, would be joining a reading group. I myself run a research group in London University that's been working on the novel for, believe it or not, 26 years.
Goodness me.
Another way of reading Ulysses, which I suppose is closest to my own in the end, is to see it as a series of puzzles, enigmas or riddles that one is constantly trying to solve with a limited but definite success.
Okay, the first of your tips there was to hear it read out loud. Could you do that for us now? You've got a passage that you'd like to read for us, Andrew.
I have.
Because I think this will help it come alive for those unfamiliar with it. I mean, one other way to help it come alive is to see it on the page, sort of in all its unpunctuated glory. But perhaps you could deliver an extract for us.
I will read passage out, but I want to be able to just say a little about it.
Please
at the end and explain it to the listeners, if I may. This is from close to the end of chapter 14 of Ulysses, also known as Oxen of the Sun. I'll read it before I explain anything about it. All off for a buster. Armstrong hollering down the street. Bonafides. Where you slept last night? Timothy of the Batter nagging. Like old Billy-O. Any brollies or gumboots in the family? Were the Henry Neville's sawbones and old Clo? Sorry, one of me knows. Hurrah there, Dix, forward to the ribbon counter. Where's Punch? All serene.
Jay, look at the drunken minister coming out of the maternity hospital. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, pater et filius. A mate, mister. The Denzil Lane boys, hell blast ye. Scoot! Righto, Isaacs. Shove him out of the bleeding limelight. Yous join us, dear sir. No hentrusion in life. Lou heap good man. Ali semi disbunch. En avant, mes enfants. Fire away, number one on the gun. Burks, Burks. Thence they advanced five paras, sang Slattery's mounted foot. Where's that bleeding orpher? Bars and Steve. Apostate's creed. No, no, Mulligan. Abaft there, shove ahead. Keep a watch on the clock. Chucking out time. Molly! What's on you? Ma mère, ma mariée, British beatitudes, rut and plat and diggity boom boom. Eyes have it. To be printed and bound at the Druid Drum Press by two designing females. Calf covers of pissed on green. Last word in art shades. Most beautiful book to come out of Ireland, my time. Silentium, get a spurt on. Tension, proceed to nearest canteen and there are next liquor stores. March. Tramp, tramp, tramp. The boys are attitude parching. Beer, beef, business, Bibles, bulldogs, battleships, buggery and bishops. Weather on the scaffold high. Beer, beef, trample the Bibles. When for Ireland, dear, trample the tramplers. Thunderation, keep the derned milling tree step. We fall. Bishop's booze box, halt. Heave to, rugger, scrum in, no touch kicking. Oh, my tootsies, you hurt. Most amazingly sorry. This is actually a passage about...
Andrew, that was wonderful.
Amazing.
And I want to speak on behalf of our listeners in saying... hugely entertaining, hugely colourful and varied in the delivery as well. But help us understand a little bit more about what you just delivered.
This passage is often treated as... It comes at the end of a chapter that has been experimenting with and playing with, crudely put, a history of English prose styles. And it's often viewed as a kind of modern collapse of grand English prose styles into the demotic, into varied kinds of slang, different kinds of ethnic versions of English, pidgin English, for instance, American Black English, a whole diversity of street English, in effect. And that's its style. But what's actually going on here is a kind of experience that I imagine quite a few of your listeners might have been through. It's about a group of young men who've been drinking in a maternity hospital, who are students, who are now heading half drunk to the nearest pub. And this is the exchange between them. They're all students, or almost all students, as they're heading towards the pub. And that last little bit that I read, halt, heave to, rugger, scrum in, they're going in through the pub door. That's what it's about. There is an extremely basic situation here, as I say, familiar to a lot of modern men, that is actually being written up in a kind of exchange between them. They're all playing with language, as young men very frequently do. They're playing with language in lots of interesting ways. They're bringing in and quoting bits and pieces of Latin, bits and pieces of French, as a group of students might do. But it's all run together as though it's a style. It's an extraordinary achievement in itself.
Professor Andrew Gibson, thank you so much for coming in and helping us to understand Ulysses a bit more. And indeed, in Dublin, celebrations of James Joyce's work are ongoing throughout the week.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we will be heading to Islamabad for the news from Pakistan with our lady there, Samira Shackle. We will review the Italian front pages with our own Italophile researcher, David Pleasant, and we'll find out why coffee and technology are a potent mix in Israel.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Turkish riot police have cleared the square in Istanbul where anti-government demonstrations began almost 2 weeks ago. Thousands of people were in Taksim Square when police stormed it on Tuesday evening. Thousands of people spent the night at the headquarters of Greece's state TV channel ERT in a show of support after the government shut it down on Tuesday evening without warning to save money. The Obama administration has launched an internal review of the potential damage to national security from leaks about US surveillance efforts. And the American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit in the US District Court challenging the legality of the telephone surveillance program. Volkswagen to recall almost 26,000 cars in Australia in response to potential gearbox problems. The company says it'll be recalling Jetta, Polo, Passat and Caddy models manufactured between June 2008 and September 2011. The world's oldest person, the 116-year-old Japanese man Jiromon Kimura, has died. He's survived by 7 children, 14 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren and 15 great-great-grandchildren. An Australian woman will today try to become the first person ever to make the 103-mile swim between Cuba and the Florida Keys without a shark cage to protect her. Chloe McArdle expects to take 60 hours to swim from Havana to the shores of Key West. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi and Dominic Reynolds.
Indeed. For today's preview of our weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs, we're heading to Israel, where a booming technology sector has become one of the most important exports the country has to offer. Driving this innovation is an established and largely independent cafe culture, where the tech minds can meet to exchange ideas.
One new Israeli application entitled CUPS, or quite simply CUPS, marries Tel Aviv's cafe circuit and the startup scene. The Entrepreneurs team sent Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Dana to Tel Aviv to find out about where tech and coffee meet and to unpack the secret behind the city's cafe culture.
One invariably thinks of sun and sea when Tel Aviv is brought up in conversation. The city has developed a strong reputation as a bastion of brittle hedonism in a radically changing Middle East, an enclave of liberal attitudes and lifestyles amidst a sea of religious conservatism. While the partying can still be found, Tel Aviv is maturing. Fueled by a growing tech sector, Tel Aviv's cafes are now more popular than its famous bars.
Tel Aviv cafes differ from one another, but I think the one thing they have in common is they can serve as a home.
That is Yuval Ben-Ami, a Tel Aviv-based writer and journalist, whose recent book, A Tel Aviv Comedy, chronicles the literary life of one of Tel Aviv's most famous cafes, the Little Prince.
You start in the morning with coffee, you can move on to a light lunch, then more coffee, then dinner, then a beer, then sometimes a DJ moves in and it becomes a club, and then morning comes again and you can have a coffee again. So basically you can live in them.
As the city matures, shedding its former party skin for one more focused on technology and international business, its cafes have become incubators of innovation. This transition was not lost on Alon Ezer. Along with four others, he created a mobile application that blends Tel Aviv's love of coffee and tech, called CUPS.
CUPS was founded by a group of five people. We are all Tel Avivian and we know the cafe culture and we know the atmosphere that's going on here. And everyone that's visited Tel Aviv knows that it's all about the beach and the coffee places and the atmosphere is really free and people like to enjoy life. And we searched for an idea that can easily be implemented in the city and can be developed really quick and can catch really quick. CUPS was actually, you know, very Tel Avivian.
קאפס הוא מנוי לקפה ללא הגבלה. בעזרת המנוי תוכלו לשתות כמה קפה שתרצו, מתי שתרצו.
The idea behind CUPS is actually quite simple. You download an application to your mobile device, which uses your device's GPS to locate the nearest cafe. With two subscription models for coffee consumption, unlimited or cup a day, you are able to drink coffee throughout the city without your wallet. For roughly $50 a month, users can drink as much coffee as they want at over 60 different independent cafes in the city. Waiters simply enter a code into the customer's mobile device to track how much coffee is drunk. For Ezer, the idea behind CUPS was to embrace Tel Aviv's love of independent cafes.
Tel Avivian are a big fans of little places, those small cafes where you can come and even know the owner of the cafe by heart. And this is what they are looking for. When you think about it, this is actually what we're doing. CAPS is a network of coffee shops, of individual coffee shops. And we let those coffee shops enjoy the strength that a coffee shop chain has without losing its individual aspects and individual design and atmosphere.
So what exactly is Tel Aviv's secret? How has the city managed to create a dynamic cafe culture that has become an integral part of the city's growing startup sector? According to Yuval Ben-Ami, the answer is all about the relationship between the cafe and the neighborhood.
Somehow, this city retained the dynamics of cafes elsewhere in history that was lost there. For example, the Parisian cafe. Tel Aviv's cafes were never tourist destinations. They are untouched by that. At their best, foreigners don't know them. Strangers don't find them. The community comes there. Because Tel Aviv does not attract tourists the way Paris does, or even Brussels, anywhere in Europe, our cafes remained centered around communities.
CUPS is the latest attempt to harness the power of the Tel Aviv cafe climate. As Yuval Ben-Ami told me, you find just about everything in the Tel Aviv cafe circuit, including cafes that don't serve anything.
Cafes are a place of innovation in terms of business, just as they are a place of innovation in terms of artwork that attacks business. There's something in the coffee that is a nutrient for anything that demands a nutrient to grow, whether it's business, whether it's creativity, whether it's politics. Coffee makes our minds move. In fact, not only coffee. I remember there was a cafe established on Schenken Street that was called Cafe Keilu. It was in the 90s. And they didn't serve coffee. They didn't serve anything. They said, okay, people go to cafes not for coffee. They go to chat with each other. So they can put 5 shekels and we will give them water. All they served was water. And people went there until it turned out to have been an arts project of some college student. And people fell for it.
From Beirut to Berlin, cafes are some of the oldest urban spaces for intellectual innovation throughout the world. Often the greatest moments of innovation in a given city's history can be traced to a cafe. Tel Aviv feels as though its cafe culture is finally coming into its own, happy to blend Middle Eastern and European traditions with a firm eye on being incubators for Israel's next generation of rugged entrepreneurs. For Monocle, in Tel Aviv, I'm Joseph Dana.
Thank you very much, Joseph. Coffee fueling the minds in here as well from the Monocle Cafe. How's yours, Marcus?
Oh, it's amazing. Do you know how many times I go there every day?
I don't want to know.
Finns are the most coffee-consuming nation in the world, unless
Carl the other
day. It's a fact.
Why?
It's a fact. It's about 12.5 kilos every year we drink.
Per person?
Per person.
Wow, you measure your consumption in kilos.
That's about 7 Monocle Cafe cups a day.
Deary me. And is this connected to the absence of sunlight for protracted periods of time, do you think?
No, it's not, but it's connected to my restlessness in the afternoon and me losing concentration very much.
So it's all connected to you.
Yeah.
So it's, wow, you must get through a lot if you've changed the entire annual consumption of a nation. You can hear more business reports from around the globe, from an attorney turned successful hotelier in Texas to an urban farm in Helsinki built on an old railway turntable. Wow. Did you know about that one, Marcus?
I didn't actually. I need to listen to that
That's
episode.
That's the beauty of the entrepreneurs, and you can hear it at 1900 hours London time.
But now you are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with our woman in Islamabad.
This weekend, come and join us for Monocle's very own take on an old English tradition. The second annual Monocle Country Fair will feature a selection of our favourite nations, retailers and delicacies. Wales, Colombia and Sweden will all be showcasing their wares and will have clothing from Drake's, Henchman and Trunk. And of course, the all-press cart will be serving piping hot coffee throughout the weekend. Plus, we've got a petting zoo for the little ones. So come down to Midori House on Dorset Street, Marylebone, London this weekend for the second annual Monocle Country Fair. And that's fair with a Y, of course.
Thank you.
You are listening to Midori House. The time is 12:44 in Islamabad and 8:44 here in London.
And it is indeed time to head to Pakistan for a look at the headlines there with our woman in Islamabad, Samira Shackle. Samira, welcome back to Midori House. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And you?
Yes, very well, thanks. We have been talking about the troubles Barack Obama has been having in the US recently, of course. One thing it stopped people talking about is his policy on drones, and Nawaz Sharif has started talking about drones, hasn't he?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it was one of the big issues during the election campaign. Both Nawaz Sharif, who's now been sworn in as Prime Minister, and Imran Khan, who is his main competitor, really, both stood on a platform vowing to end drone attacks. Nawaz Sharif has now been sworn in as Prime Minister. We've seen two US drone attacks in recent weeks, one of which was after he was sworn in, which is slightly embarrassing for the government. So we're sort of wondering where that's going to go. The fact is Nawaz Sharif has spoken out against the military policy of publicly condemning drones while secretly allowing them. But the question is how far he's going to be able to change that. I mean, the fact is the military likes drones. They attacked the Taliban leadership. They broke up their chains of command. But politically, it's become a real hot potato. It's a focus for anti-American sentiment. It's going to be quite a difficult thing for Nawaz Sharif to navigate.
Do you know what's been going on behind the scenes? Has he done something this far to try to end the strikes?
Well, thus far, I mean, after the strike that took place after he was sworn in, he called in the US ambassador, and by all accounts, he didn't give him quite the dressing down you might expect from the public rhetoric he's been employing. He told him that it damages cooperation and it's not good for the two nations. It's going to be difficult. So that the Imran Khan's party, the PTI, have put through a resolution about asking to take military action to end drone strikes if the US doesn't end them. That puts Nawaz Sharif in a very difficult position. Of course, it would be sort of international diplomatic suicide to take military action to sort of shoot down drones. Yet he's going to have to avoid looking like he's flip-flopping and carrying on the policies of his predecessors by rejecting it. So it seems like there's some diplomatic, there's a lot of diplomatic discussions going on. There's some suggestion that Nawaz Sharif might be offering to for Pakistan to take further action to attack camps and headquarters and bases in return for stopping the drone strikes. But it's still very much in flux at the moment.
Well, while we're talking about things that Nawaz Sharif has promised to find a solution to, the energy crisis, of course, an enormous problem across Pakistan, even in the cities. How is he going to find a solution?
Yes, it's a huge problem. I mean, I'm speaking to you at the moment from a room with no air conditioning and no power in it. It's off roughly half the time, I'd say, in Islamabad, and that's the capital city. It's a huge problem for industry. It's estimated it's costing about 2% of GDP every year, because if you think about factories, small businesses losing power for between 8 and 16 hours a day, depending on where they are, huge extra expense of generators. Now, it's a huge priority for the government, and everyone's said, you know, it's almost a truism now, people saying, well, if he doesn't fix it, then he's not going to last long. The question is how, really. So the things they're looking at, the government, which are probably going to be announced in today's budget, which is being announced this evening at 6 p.m., in gradually increasing energy tariffs. There's currently a huge gap between what people are paying and what it costs. There's a lot of government subsidies, which the government can't afford. That's creating a problem of sort of circular debt between government, people, and energy companies. There's also going to be just a sort of look at sources of energy, because there's an energy deficit. We're not, you know, Pakistan's not producing enough. There's been some talk of Saudi Arabia pitching in to help, but it certainly is a high priority for this government.
You already mentioned the federal budget that is going to be announced very soon. What else can we expect from it?
Well, there's going to be, in addition to this focus on the energy crisis, there's going to be reductions in all non-development expenditure. So it was reported earlier this week that all ministries are expected to cut their spending by 30%, which is a really big, sizable chunk off those budgets. The question is whether that's going to happen, because there's a problem of maintaining fiscal control here. So poor parliamentary checks on supplementary grants means that the actual spending on any given area often far exceeds the budget. So we might also expect some action tightening up on those loopholes, because Nawaz Sharif really has sort of staked his reputation on restoring fiscal credibility. We can, on the other hand, while there's this big sort of belt tightening on all non-development expenditure, expect some investment in development projects. So that's partly the energy issue we've spoken about already, also some infrastructure projects. So Nawaz Sharif's party won a lot of plaudits in the last parliament for infrastructure projects they introduced in Punjab, like a metro bus system in Lahore. So they're looking at introducing a similar system in Karachi, buses between the twin cities of Islamabad and Rawalpindi, as well as looking at things like water supply, energy, and the costs for these projects are supposedly going to be met through aggressive taxation. So there's currently a big problem that, you know, basically no one pays tax. It's something like 1% of the population. That's partly because a lot of the population is too poor to pay tax, but there's also a huge level of tax evasion, tax avoidance on a really mind-boggling scale. So,
Samira, lots to be done. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Clearly, lots to be done there. Lots of issues which we will come back to you on as you measure the progress of Nawaz Sharif in his new / old job. Our woman in Pakistan is Samira Shackle. Thanks very much for your time.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Milano Jazz Dance Combo now to warm you up for a roundup of the Italian press in just a moment. This is Feeling Good featuring Catherine Rusto.
That was the Milano Jazz Dance Combo there, of course. And it's time for a roundup of this morning's Italian newspapers. And for this, we're joined by David Pleasant, who is our Italophile?
Italo-disco expert. I don't know. Hello, Dominic.
Hello.
Italophile.
A man of many talents, David Pleasant. So what's the biggest story in the Italian press this morning?
Well, the papers are still going through the results of Sunday and Monday's elections. So it's basically just a bit of a landslide, really, for the centre-left, taking up a lot of the votes that were previously in the five-star movement. So last year, the general election, they performed very well, took about a third of those votes. Those votes seem to have kind of directly shifted into the centre-left's hands.
Yeah, a landslide on one side, and whatever the reverse of a landslide is for Beppe Grillo's five-star movement.
Exactly, a collapse. The La Repubblica is saying... He's called for a referendum on himself. So he says, tell me all if the problem is me. This is after a senator who is part of his party, Senator Gambaro, said that it's all your fault, she accused Pepe Grillo. And in a way, it kind of is. He's been a kind of dictator amongst his own party in some many ways.
How expected was this result?
Well, that's a good question. There's been so much infighting within the five-star movement, and there was never really any chance that they'd go ahead and deliver so many of their proposals. Partly because they refused to join in with any coalition or even collaborate or help with any of the formal government parties that formed a grand coalition. So it's really no surprise that they weren't able to carry out any of their actions.
And Mr. Grillo continuing with his sort of apolitical, sort of not what you expect from a politician stance with this "tell me if I'm the problem" business.
Exactly, but it looks like, you know, he's really, I mean, he might not be around for much longer by the way that the papers are reporting the problems within the party.
Interesting. Let's talk the Pope and the gay lobby.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Apparently exists in the Vatican, really?
Yeah, this is actually, it's a bit more serious than it sounds. In a Chilean newspaper, a Catholic Chilean newspaper, Reflexión y Liberación, he said that, yes, sadly, a gay lobby does exist within the Curia, the Vatican. This is in response to the Vatican, the so-called Vati leaks that happened last year with Paolo Gabriella, the butler who came out with all sorts of scandals of the shenanigans within the Vatican. The Pope was answering to that. So, I mean, it's quite strong words from him.
Do we know how the Pope is going to be dealing with this gay lobby?
I don't know.
Affectionately.
What's quite interesting is the reaction. He's saying it's in a kind of negative way, and he says that the Pope is, I mean, the Vatican is filled with very good people, but this gay lobby is obviously part of the ominous dark cloud within the Vatican. So slightly disturbing kind of terms from the Vatican still. Let's see what happens, but it's pretty strong words. And this is all part of his very outward, clear, kind of no-frills way of talking to the media.
Well, one more story from one of the papers you have over there in front of you. L'Unione Sarda is the name of the paper.
Yes, that's right. That's the Sardinian Daily, the Sardinian Union. This is a continuing story affecting the 2 million islanders of Sardinia. Recently, the island's main ferry service was privatised. That's called Tirrenia. That was privatised and bought by a kind of maverick entrepreneur. Since then, prices of the crossing, which is a long crossing, it's about 10 hours, have rocketed. And this is really affecting the island's economy. And so they've continuing blockades of the ports, including the island's capital, Cagliari, that the port has been blocked for several days. This is obviously going to affect everything on Sardinia is brought in from the mainland. So it's quite serious if you live in Sardinia.
Concerning stuff. And I'm afraid that's all we can talk to you about, David, because time will not allow us anymore. But David Pleasant is our Italian expert.
Thank you very much.
And that is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Alid John. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and Chris Fitch was the expert studio manager. Next up after the news, it's the latest episode of The Menu. I hate the presenter of The Menu. What is that guy's name?
What is the coincidence that he is actually going to stay on there, Marcus Hippie?
I'm warming your seat for you, Marcus. I bet that's going to entice you. That's The Menu.
Lovely. Today we find out, by the way, in the program we find out what it has taken to get the first Michelin star to Poland. Dominic and Sophie Grove will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow.
Yes, we will. I'm looking forward to it. But for today, that was Midori House. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.